Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good evening, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. We are also on the internet at cgsf.ca, where we stream in podcast Endeavors and all your favorite shows. And of course, you can find us on Telus HD channel 7014. We're back to three interviews today. I know it's been a while. I'm going to call today's show the Revolutionary Episode. And you'll understand why in a minute. For our first guest is a scholar and professor of, I guess, Middle Eastern studies, we could say. He has a new book out called Once Upon a Revolution, which basically details the Egyptian Revolution from 2011 up until about, last year or so. It's a very, very interesting look at an issue that we here in the West don't know too much about. So his name is Thanasis Kambasis, and he'll be here. You'll also, we were supposed to have Pasi Cylinder, who's one of the deputy directors in Helsinki of their education, to talk about Finland's new education policy, but that's been moved to Wednesday. So you're going to hear a re-airing of an interview with Larry Seams, who is the editor of the book Guantanamo Diary, about a man who's been held in Guantanamo without charge for 15 years or so. And we have a music guest today for the first time in a while. Music's coming back. 19-year-old phenom Scott Hellman will be joining us. But right now, our first guest is a journalist specializing in Middle Eastern and America foreign policy, and is a fellow at the Century Foundation. We started calling for the Boston Globe, called The Internationalist, and is also correspondent to The Atlantic and has contributed to The New York Times, Foreign Affairs, and National Interest. He previously published a book in 2011 about Hezbollah called A Privilege to Die, and his new book is just came out called Once Upon a Revolution. He also teaches at Columbia's University School of International and Public Affairs and at the New School's Graduate Program in International Affairs. He is Thanasis Kambasis, Thanasis Kambanis, and he joined me earlier today from Beirut. And on the line with me now is Thanasis Kambanis, author of Once Upon a Revolution. Hello, Thanasis. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
So I was reading up about how this book came to be, and I understand that you were actually in Egypt around the time of the spring in 2011?
Yeah, what happened actually was that I had been in Egypt reporting the year before, in 2010, and I had gone back to New York, and I saw the first protest of January 25th on television from New York, and I went sort of crazy because I'd spent at that point almost nearly a decade reporting in the Arab world, and really this was the kind of cataclysmic change or just sort of a black swan event that we had always, or at least I had always hoped would happen, and had sort of grown to expect would never come to pass. So to be away from it was intolerable. Fortunately, it wasn't a one-day event, so I was able to hop on an airplane and get there in the early days of Tahrir Square and be there for the sort of peak of the first stage of the uprising.
When you were there in 2010, was there any inkling that something was brewing?
Well, I mean, you know, there were lots of different things happening, and none of them None of them, to my view, spelled imminent uprising. So, you know, back in the summer of 2010, there were these protests against police brutality that spontaneously sprung up after the murder of a young internet. I mean, he was sort of billed as an internet kid, but he was just a guy named Khalid Saeed, who was just a normal 20-something kid who hung out at internet cafes. It seems like he, you know, smoked a bit of pot. One day he was beaten to death by the cops, the kind of thing that was typical in Mubarak, Egypt, and sadly is typical in Egypt again today. And somewhat unexpectedly, there was a groundswell of anger among the normally apolitical youth, the working class and middle class youth who had really stayed away from protests or politics. But these protests were small, so they would call not sit-ins, but sort of stand-ins, silent stands, where people would hold signs and stand beside the road in Alexandria without saying anything. And these were interesting, but they drew a couple of hundred people. There was a lot of activity around this cause on Facebook, but nothing large and nothing that to an eye like my own and that of many much more knowledgeable observers amounted to a radical shift in what was happening. And even that fall, there was some heavy manipulation of the parliamentary elections. It was probably the worst, the most abusive case of electoral fraud in Mubarak, Egypt, and that's been a long history of fraud. And even that didn't really mean, you know, the small political class was outraged. A couple of hundred people demonstrated. And it seemed as late in the game as the first week of January 2000 or the last week of December 2010 that nothing was going to change.
You mentioned apolitical youth. And I know in Once Upon a Revolution, you focus on the stories of two men. One was who was sort of an activist within the Muslim community, and one who was a secular liberal. How did you decide to focus on those two people in particular? And would you say their stories are typical of what people were feeling during that time?
Well, the way I came to report the story the way I did, when I went to Tahrir Square, I was interested in the question of political change and political activism. So I actually intentionally sought out the activists from the first week in Tahrir, the activists who were concerned with contesting political power and transforming the political system. So these were people who were overtly believed that politics was part of their struggle, of their revolutionary fight. And that quest led me to something called the Revolutionary Youth Coalition, which was a very ad hoc, loose a body of activists from the left to the right, Islamists, non-Islamists, sort of all the activists who had been activists from before January 2011. So I ended up following about 12 of those people over the course of the next 3 to 4 years. And when I wrote the book, I chose to focus on two people whose journeys I thought were the most revealing and helped us best understand some of the most important aims and failures of the revolution. So, you know, I had quite a large choice of characters, and ultimately, I mean, all of them were compelling, all of them were interesting, and for the sake of telling a story, I focused on two. And I'll tell you really quickly about them and why I chose them. One was the Muslim Brotherhood pharmacist. His name was Muaz. I chose him because he was someone who really typified the driven, committed Islamist milieu, and he was also very typical of a very small but very admirable trend of people who really questioned authority, including the authority of their own movement. So Muaz was someone who was willing to put his life on the line against Mubarak and police brutality, but he was also willing to put himself on the line to defy the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood, which ultimately expelled him. The other character I ended up choosing to focus on was named Bassem, and he was a 40-something architect at the beginning of the time the revolution began. And what made him interesting was he was someone who really had stayed away from politics, and he was older than your typical youth activist, although by Egyptian standards, 40 is pretty young. And he was someone who was smart, pretty successful, bourgeois, had very limited aims, which, you know, he wanted his kids to get a good education, he wanted his family to do okay, and it was a sign of just how broken and corrupt Egypt had become that a guy like him was driven to radical revolutionary politics, although he stayed within the sort of boundaries of what we in the West would think of as sort of social democracy or classical liberalism. He was never a fire-breathing radical.
You mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood, and I want to touch on that because it seems at least out here in the West there was a lot of misinformation about the Muslim Brotherhood, or just things that we didn't know about them. Do you chalk that up to just simply cultural differences, misinformation between West and East, Islamophobia, or was there some other aspect involved that caused us to sort of look at the Muslim Brotherhood differently than they actually were?
Well, that's a very very complicated set of questions you're asking, and all those factors are in play. I mean, the actual narrative of what happened in Egypt, and I mean, this is one of the problems we face in the West, is that we often have people who want to have some kind of discourse about Islamism in general, or Islamists, or the Muslim Brotherhood in the whole region, when in fact it's specific political parties in each country that behave and act differently, and so when In my case, I'm talking about right now the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is one distinct political movement. And there we had a lot of propaganda and Islamophobia shaping the view of the Muslim Brotherhood, not just from the West, but from within the ranks of secular extremists inside Egypt. The kinds of people who would prefer a military dictatorship over a democratically elected Islamist. But we also had active disinformation by the Islamists themselves as well. And sadly, one of the things that happened was the Muslim Brotherhood was by far the most popular party in the first rounds of elections, and won a dominant parliamentary majority. They won the presidency by a narrow margin, and then they proceeded to govern with unbelievable disdain for the process that brought them to power. So they turned out in power to be as prone to autocracy and indifferent to the rule of law and the public as the secular liberal parties that they defeated at the polls. And certainly from my point of view, one of the really sad developments over the first 3 years of Egypt's transformation is that neither the Muslim Brothers nor the secular liberals nor the reformers were actually committed to reform. They were all engaged in a struggle to take over the machinery of a police state and use it for their own ends. And in the end, none of the powerful groups like the Brotherhood or like the old WAFT party, which is nominally liberal but is essentially a secular authoritarian, none of them actually had any interest in any of the trappings of an accountable, reformist, democratic, or open process. And that was quite sad.
It first started with the overthrow of Mubarak, then we had the Muslim Brotherhood, then we had Morsi. And I think the opinion of at least those here in the West covering this story was that all of them have been either a failure or dictatorial. From someone who covers the Middle East for a living, what does Egypt need to do to have a more successful democratic political system?
Well, I mean, let me start by saying at this point I'm not very optimistic that it will have an open, accountable, transparent, representative democratic system anytime soon, unfortunately. But I do think inevitably over the long term, there will be more of an opening, we have to look carefully at the different
people involved, but also with the process that leads them to power. So, you know, Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood were dictatorial in power, but that's actually not at all the same thing as today's dictatorship run by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and the army, which is in power and is also dictatorial. What's the difference? In the current case, we have a military leader who came to power in a coup. He controls all the dominant institutions of the security state, and he has the ability, which he's used, to imprison people by the tens of thousands, murder unarmed demonstrators by the thousands, and crush and silence dissent from a position of power that he took through no public democratic accountable process. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, when they were in power, when Morsi was the president, they were no saints. They were corrupt and abusive and authoritarian, but many things were different. One, they came to power by free elections as part of a dialectical process, which does not justify their misbehavior, but does, in my view, suggest that their rule was going to be part of a dialectic process of change in which, at the end, Egypt was going to end up in a much better and accountable place than it is today. Also, at that time, we actually had a kind of healthy pluralism in the sense that the Muslim Brotherhood controlled some of the apparatuses of government. The police controlled their own fiefdom. The army controlled its own fiefdom. So did the courts. Now, this was problematic for a lot of reasons, the division of the state, competition between different power bases and bureaucracies, making it hard for citizens to get things they needed done. But it actually prevented anyone from having absolute power and absolute authority. And this was a very healthy and new thing for Egypt. I remain convinced today that had Egypt remained on a path where these very real and very visceral differences were contested through politics rather than through gunplay or winner-takes-all authoritarian standoff, that we would end up not necessarily at a Western-style democracy, but that we would end up at a system that's much more open, accountable, flexible, and interested in the rights of its citizens than the one we have today.
I remember talking with Irshad Manji a few years ago, and one of the things that she said is it's not about, you know, Islam and secularism and Christianity, more that it has to do with Arab tribal culture, and that is really the heart of the issues in there, both the political and the religious. What do you say to that? Is the tribal nature of the Arab world somehow inherently more different or violent or misogynistic than the rest?
Yeah, I definitely don't see it that way. I'm not an essentialist. I don't think that there's something about Arabs or the Arab world that predisposes them to behave in a certain way politically, or that determines their political systems. I mean, we've had, you know, violent, torture-prone regimes in European countries, in you know, all over the world, and I think, you know, frankly, there's no serious evidence. And it smacks a little bit of lazy, intellectual laziness, if not of racism, to start looking at the character of Arabs or Africans or Asians or Europeans to try and explain the political systems that they're living under. Now, what we do have in the Arab world is we have a distinct political economy today, and a distinct history of authoritarian and abusive regimes, which is very real, and one which we need to deal with. One of the struggles is between Islamists and secularists, and that actually is an important axis. Both of these are trends that come out of Arab, primarily Muslim political class. But that is one of the big fights, and I actually see that as a central problem, which is that Arab politics for the entire post-colonial period has been obsessed with the question of decolonization and the question of Arab nationalism and how to resolve the tension between religious parties and secular parties. None of these ideas have any room for the things that I actually think are essential for the Arab world to thrive, and that is pluralism, a civic identity based on rights and citizenship, a construct of national identity that leaves room for the non-religious people who live there, the non-Arabs who live here, the non-Muslims who live here. And that is increasingly a problem when you look at a country like Egypt that's more than 10% Christian, whose Muslim population is largely secular, and yet we have a self-image and a political identity that imagines everyone as a robust religious Muslim who's an Arab nationalist and Egyptian patriot, it doesn't leave any room for politics. And that's the root of the problem.
Well, it's a fascinating look into the world that we know so little about, but I got to end it there. The book is Once Upon a Revolution. Listeners should check it out. Thanasis Kambanis, thanks so much for your time today.
Great to be with you.
All right, cheers. And once again, that was Thanasis Kambanis, professor at Columbia University. His new book is Once Upon a Revolution, and he joined me from Beirut. Okay, we're going to have a couple of announcements, and then you're going to hear from the wonderful musician, Mr. Scott Hellman. And welcome back to the show. And of course, you just before the break, you heard an interview with Thanasis Kambanis. Now we're going to be switching gears a little bit, and you'll be hearing from Scott Hellman. He's only 19, and yet he just released his first EP titled Augusta. And I had a chance to speak with him last week about his process and his evolution as a musician. I'm here with possibly Canada's next superstar, Scott Hellman. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
It's a nice little introduction.
They've really been touting you, so I gotta live up to what they're saying about you. So Augusta is your new work of art. How did this come about for you? I read that you were in contact with an executive at Warner, and they sort of pushed you in a certain direction.
Yeah, I put up some stuff on YouTube, and Ron Lapata, who I work with now from the label, he's my A&R guy, he heard it and put me behind a mic, and we just went from there. Like, I was writing with people and just developing my songwriting skills and making art and stuff, and now I'm here.
You kind of went on a big writing spree prior to this album. How would you describe your overall process?
Like, for the album or generally?
Well, just like when you generally sort of write a song, how would you say?
It really depends. Like, it depends firstly if I'm co-writing with someone. Like, it depends on how they operate, and I try to write very organically. Like, I don't have really like a system, but I'm just constantly walking around, like, putting stuff in a notebook or writing thoughts down, or I like to keep, like, a journal and stuff, and just think a lot about, like, what my next song's going to be. And then in terms of writing a song, it's so dependent on, like, whatever you're inspired by, so it's really hard to say about
it. Speaking of inspiration, I read that Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon was kind of marked a musical turning point for you. What was it about that album that spoke to you?
It was the fact that, like, for me, like, when I was listening to music as a kid, like, I didn't really find music that I could identify with. Like, I was a pretty deep thinking, like, little kid, like, angsty little teenage kid. And when I heard Dark Side of the Moon, like, not only was the fact that it was a concept album and the whole thing was a piece of art, like, that freaking blew my mind. But at the same time, like, it was discussing themes, like, songs like Time and Breathe and Us and Them and those kinds of songs, like, we're discussing themes that I'd never really heard discussed before so perfectly in music. So that was, like, really cool to me. And I always wanted to, like, achieve, like, I always wanted to have the ability to, like, boil down these, like, big philosophical thoughts to, like, a base point and express them in a song so people can go, I fully know how that feels, or I know what that person's talking about, you know?
I read that you stated that we're sort of living in a cut-and-paste world full of pop mentality. Why is that not your thing?
I don't not like pop music. I just think that pop, like, I like all music. I just like good music, and I think that when a song is good and expresses a really interesting idea that people can relate to, then that's all that matters. So if it's a pop song or a punk song or a rock song or a classic rock song or a hip-hop song, it doesn't matter to me. Like, all that matters is the content and the quality of the music. And I don't think pop music... I think pop music right now is, like, amazing. I think pop music when I was a kid was, like, it was okay. I mean, in the 90s it was cool, and then, like, early 2000s, like, Backstreet Boys kind of time, it was, like, it was mind-dribbling. It was so bothersome, and I never felt connected to music until I heard, like, the greats, like, Bob Dylan, like, Jim Morrison, like, Jimi Hendrix, all these people. Like, well, I was like, whoa, music actually can be the greatest thing in the world. And then... cooler bands started coming out and merging in the pop world. Like, Imagine Dragons is a pop band now, but I don't think 15 years ago they would have been on, like, on Chum FM, you know? So, yeah, like, yeah, I don't know. I just think music has to have quality, and I've always really, like, believed in that strongly, maybe a little too strongly, but I've always hung around people that have, like, that, like, agree on that, and I hang out with people, even, like, hip-hop people, and, like, we have these discussions about, like, how there, on one hand, there can be an artist like Kendrick Lamar, who is so amazing and is saying things that are so groundbreaking, and then there can be an artist like, what's that guy, that rapper, that Cokehead rapper guy? Anyways, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to knock.
I'm not going to knock.
But I'm just, yeah. Anyways, I don't know. I'm just babbling now.
Speaking of quality, you know, a lot of music today is under the influence of, you know, synthesizers, auto-tunes, just different types of technology. How do you think that's affected the music that we make, and but also the in a musical sense, but also lyrically?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that the ability to use these technologies affects music lyrically because it affects the way that you write songs. Like, for me, I can go and put down a beat in, like, 45 seconds, and then I can write lyrics to that. Whereas before, you had to be able to play instruments, and you had to, like, go through each thing and write it out on a piece of paper. Like, it's not like that anymore. I think that affects things both positively and negatively. Like, for one, I don't think I could have ever wrote a song like Tika without... technology like that, because I was able to make the music and then think of these ideas and record them and then listen back and then record them and listen back and stuff like that. Just, you couldn't do that in the 1960s or even like in the 90s or maybe the 80s. 90s it was getting better, but 80s you couldn't really do that. So I think it affects that. And I also, I mean, it's like everything is a good and a bad. Like, I think that electronic music is insanely cool, and the fact that we can make that kind of music now is, like, it's really interesting because it's a new form of art that has never, you know, people have never heard stuff like MGMT. Like, it's insane. But at the same time, I mean, you also have to understand that, like, an analog synth and a regular synth are two different things, and you can't substitute quality for speed or quantity. You know what I mean? Like, if you think that an instrument's going to sound better as a raw, real instrument, don't get, like... I mean, if you have money, you can use a synth, like an analog synth, but at the same time, I mean, there's people that don't have money and now they can make music. You know what I mean? And so it's so give and take. It's just a new time and it's a new art form, and I think if people are mindful about what they're making, it's all good. Sorry, I'm like tempted.
For those radio listeners, Scott likes to move his hands around a lot. Cry, Cry, Cry is one of the top songs on the album, and you've described it as about a relationship where maybe not everything goes according to plan. Songs about relationships are about as old as time itself. For you, in your opinion, why does that subject matter make for such good musical material?
I don't know, like, breakups suck, and, like, they affect your life in a real way. Like, I mean, it's really easy to write a song about, like, the government when you don't know what you're, like, you don't feel, like, it's, you can just write a song about something, but when you actually feel something and it's happening to you, it's a little bit more real. Like, I've written a ton of songs that are sort of, like, once removed from what's actually happening to me, and then I listen back, I'm like, I'm not accessing enough. And then when I break up with someone, it's like the most real thing. I mean, I look back and I'm like, what was I doing? Like, it wasn't that big of a deal, but at the time, it's so crazy. So, I don't know. I guess it's just the way I am. I'm a pretty emotional dude. When I see a girl, I'm like, oh my, you know, I just like writing songs about love. I guess that's just...
Is it, and I've talked to a lot of artists, but is it easier for you to write a song when you're feeling sad versus when you're feeling more up and happy?
I mean, I think it used to when I was younger, but I've written so many songs now, and like regimented songwriting. Like, there was a time when I would write one song a day for a week, and then I'd take a week off, and then I'd go back and I'd write a song every day for a week. And it's like, well, you have to write a song. It doesn't matter what you're feeling. You gotta put whatever you're feeling onto. So no, I mean, like, I think there's just different qualities about different moods, and you just express it in music. And
what would you say your favorite song is off Augusta?
Machine.
What is it about that track in specific that really encapsulates who you are?
I think. I was always trying to write that song for some reason. Like, when I wrote it, I was like, oh, I've been really, like, trying to get this song out, but I didn't know how to express it. And, I don't know, like, I didn't want to help people, I just wanted to, like, say something that people could listen to and feel better by listening to. And, you know, like, I have people come up to me in shows and say, like, this song really helped me, and I'm like, that's so, like, that's a gift for me to hear that, because that was my goal in the song. And it's weird because, I mean, I'm 19 and I make music and I sort of have like a thing that I do, and it's easy to identify as a musician, whereas a lot of other young people, like people that I'm friends with, are in school, and some of them have no idea what they want to do, which is totally cool, but the world for some reason is telling them that you have to know. And I'm like, dude, you're fine, you're valuable. And I just wanted to write a song that made people feel like they have value. Because, I mean, we live in a really weird world where people don't feel valuable. Like, there's so many things in the world telling you that you're not worth it, and you're not going to get there, and you're not skinny enough or fat enough or whatever. And it's like, just wanted to, like, I tried to make this simple song that people could just put on and feel better. And that's important to me.
Well, the album is Augusta. I encourage all the radio listeners to check it out. Scott Hellman, thanks so much.
Thank you, man. Cheers.
And that was Scott Hellman. And his new album is Augusta. And I'm 1FM Burnaby. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we were supposed to have an interview with Pazzi Cylinder today from Helsinki to talk about Finland's new education policy, but that's been moved to next week. So now you're going to hear a re-airing of an interview I did earlier in the year with Larry Seams, the editor of Guantanamo Diary. Larry Seams, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
So I'm intrigued and fascinated by Guantanamo Diary, which is the new book by Mohamedou Slahi that you edited. How did you first come involved with this story, with this case?
Well, I received the manuscript, his handwritten manuscript, in the summer of 2012. He wrote this manuscript in 2005, about a year after he had emerged from one of the most brutal interrogations in Guantanamo, and he remained in that isolation hut that he'd been dragged into for that interrogation. That manuscript was locked away in a secure facility outside of Washington, D.C. for almost 7 years while his legal team litigated and negotiated to have it declassified and cleared for public release. During that time, I'd been working on a project called the Torture Report with the American Civil Liberties Union, which the ACLU had gotten about 140,000 pages of government documents relating to prisoner abuse in Guantanamo, Afghanistan, Iraq, and CIA black sites, declassified through this Freedom of Information Act litigation. And my job was to sort of go through it and find characters, tell stories from these heavily redacted documents. And one of the characters who really stood out was Mohamedou Slahi, who, as I said, was, you know, one of the most brutalized in Guantanamo. And his interrogation was carefully planned according to a written special interrogation plan. And then meticulously documented. So I had, by the time I got the manuscript, I had a pretty good idea that his story, the scope of it was pretty epic. He had been held not only in Guantanamo, but the CIA had renditioned him to Jordan, where he'd been interrogated there. He'd really traveled about 20,000 miles through this gulag of intelligence prisons in five countries, gotten to Guantanamo, and then been the target of this, you know, this extremely deliberate and brutal torture. So I knew the story was going to be pretty fascinating by the time I got the manuscript in 2012. And I also had a sense that he was probably a pretty good storyteller, because there are a couple documents, like transcripts of his detainee review board hearings in Guantanamo, where he, you know, he displayed the kind of humor and wit and insight that you see in the book. So you can imagine how thrilled I was in 2012 when I got a call from his attorneys saying that they had just gotten the cleared version of the manuscript, that is the redacted version of the manuscript, and would I like to see it.
And how much of what he wrote were you actually able to publish, and how much was not redacted?
What you see on the printed page of the book is you know, what we get in terms of, you know, the cleared manuscript that the government released to the public. So, you know, the proportion of redactions to text is about the same as it is in the manuscript. The manuscript was came in at about his handwritten manuscript, about 122,000 words, which is a pretty monumental achievement when you think about the fact that English is his fourth language. The published book is about 100,000 words. So, you know, in editing it, I consolidated some things and, you know, trimmed some things the way you do when you're editing a first draft manuscript, and brought it down to about 100,000 words, as I say. But the remaining in those 100,000 words are about 2,600 black bar redactions that were imposed by the government.
And talk to us a little bit about his story. I understand that when he was about 20, he's from Mauritania, and he went to Afghanistan to join the fighters, which was, I take it, quite common for people of his age of that era.
It was very common, and that was actually not his biggest, you know, and most remarkable journey at that point in his life. The most remarkable thing is he's the ninth of 12 children of a, you know, quite a poor family in Mauritania. His father was a camel trader. The family moved to the capital of Mauritania, Nouakchott, when he was a teenager, right about the time his father died. He was quite a brilliant student, obviously, and won a scholarship to study electrical engineering in Germany. So at 18, he became the first member of his family to get on a plane, to leave the country, to go to university. And so he did that, arriving in Germany in 1988. In 1991, as you say, he did something that many young men at the time did, which was, you know, went to Afghanistan to join the Mujahideen units that were fighting the communist-backed government in Kabul. And he, to do that, you had to train in a camp, and he trained in an Al-Qaeda camp in 1991, went back to Germany, studied some more. The following year, and kind of the final days of the communist-backed government, went back to Afghanistan for about a month, was there for one of the last battles. And then as soon as Kabul fell in 1992, the Mujahideen factions started shooting at each other. He said, I'm done with this. I'm done with Al-Qaeda. I didn't join up to fight other Muslims. And so he went back to Germany and, you know, picked up his studies, got his degree, and ended up living and working as an engineer in Germany throughout the 90s, you know, pointing out, as he often has in his hearings and habeas corpus case, that, you know, he had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda's fight with the U.S. They hadn't even been declared war on the U.S. when he was involved with them. And in fact, at the time he was, you know, in Afghanistan, the U.S. was an active supporter of these very same factions. So, you know, he's been quite clear that his Al-Qaeda experience ended in 93, and he had nothing to do with, you know, any antagonisms against the U.S.
We're seeing these days a very large and a very violent, almost violent, anti-Islam, anti-Muslim sentiment. And he's from a Muslim country. And I'm curious as to whether you think his stint and his interrogation in Guantanamo, not only has to do with the fact that he fought allegedly with Al-Qaeda, but also that he's Muslim?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's certainly one that he explores throughout the text. You know, he talks about the feeling of, you know, of the moment of a particular animus directed toward the Arab world, you know, spawned, as he recognizes, even by the kind of fear and panic after the 9/11 attacks. It's interesting. There was a really wonderful review of the book in the New York Times Book Review by Mark Danner, and I thought he quite eloquently talked about the kind of the way in which prisoners like Mohammed Uslahi became the projection of our fears. And you see that a lot in the, you know, his recount of the interrogation session. And one of the, among the many incredible things about the book is that I think it's one of the most riveting looks at, you know, multi-year interrogation that I've ever seen in literature. Just that, you know, that kind of ongoing, relentless questioning that goes on, and the frustration of the interrogators. And you know, the interrogators, at one point they say, "Well, you fit our profile. You know, you're smart." He says, and Muhammad says, "Well, what's the profile?" And they say, "Well, you're really smart. You have an electrical engineering degree. You speak a lot of languages. You know, you've lived in several countries, you know." And Muhammad says, you know, well, you know, so what? And you think about it, those are the things that actually, you know, sound like the resume of a really excellently successful immigrant son, you know? But it's like we lived, you know, that moment was a moment where you could look at that same set of facts about somebody's life and add in the projection of fear and anxiety that was prompted by the 9/11 attacks and read it entirely differently, that this guy must be some kind of, as he, you know, he put it, super intelligent, super smart terrorist, and of course he wasn't.
His story reminds me a lot of Mazyar Bahari, the Iranian journalist who was immortalized in Jon Stewart's recent movie Rosewater. I'm curious.
Right.
I'm curious for you, A, if you see any parallels between those two stories, but also if the U.S.'s torture methods are becoming the same as the terrorists that they're trying to defeat.
Well, I think a really interesting aspect of the book, and I think it's a really apt comparison to make, because, you know, even within the book, Mohammadi describes interrogations in intelligence prisons in five different countries: Senegal, Mauritania, Jordan, you know, under the U.S. in Bagram, Afghanistan, and in Guantanamo. You know, it's interesting because there's a kind of sameness to, you know, to intelligence prisons and intelligence interrogation operations. The structures of the prisons with the hierarchies of guards and interrogators, for example, and, you know, and prison officialdom, and the way the guards kind of, you know, are restricted in the ways they can interact with prisoners, but they can't help but transgress those boundaries and, you know, form relationships with the prisoners, and the way interrogators, you know, some of them are, you know, also form bonds, so the way some of them are quite sadistic, you know, and Mazyar's book falls, you know, within that same experience. I mean, I think, you know, there's, I'm sure, a global technology of torture, you know, that countries have been trading back and forth for a long, long time. And we know that the interrogation techniques that were used by defense intelligence agency interrogators in Mohammadi's special projects interrogation were developed alongside and really modeled on the enhanced interrogation techniques, quote unquote, that were, you know, being developed and implemented in the CIA's black site prisons. And we know from, you know, a great deal of literature and declassified information that those techniques themselves were developed by, you know, these two contract psychologists who were drawing on this program called SERE, Survive, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, that they put, you know, American airmen through who might be shot down over enemy, you know, in enemy territory and held captive in countries that torture. Specifically, they're modeled on techniques that were used by the North Koreans during the Korean War. And so, you know, I think there's been a global trade and in interrogation techniques and in torture. And the really disheartening thing is that after 9/11, you know, we entered vigorously into that commerce and adopted many of these things ourselves.
I know that you, before you edited the Guantanamo Diary, you had authored a book on the torture report, and we just saw another torture report on the CAA released last year. And I'm curious, in the course of your research, what did you find out in terms of how rampant and systemic these tortures were, and if you have any theories as to the reasons for it?
That's a really great question and a very interesting one. I mean, they were absolutely systemic, and systemic in the sense that they were, you know, established and coordinated at the highest levels of the Bush administration. Rampant is not so clear, and it probably, you can say almost the opposite, just because these programs were kept secret from not only from the American public, but even from the majority of people in the agencies that were carrying out the program. So, for example, the CIA program, you know, that was developed and being implemented in the black sites around the world, you know, most CIA agents had no idea this was going. And in fact, one of the reasons that we have that, you know, amazing Senate report that was released in December is because, you know, by 2002 and 2003, CIA agents were sort of, you know, being sent to these places and discovering what was going on there. And they were coming back to Langley and saying, you know, you can't believe what's going on out there. And it prompted a major investigation by the CIA's inspector general that included, you know, reams of documents that, as I say, you know, really led to and resulted in this, you know, amazing Senate report. And the same is really true for Guantanamo. You know, and it's an interesting aspect of Mohamedou's story, one of the reasons that I think the story has a kind of epic feel to it, because, you know, Guantanamo, he arrives in the middle of this epic struggle between the FBI and criminal intelligence, you know, a criminal investigative task force agents on the one hand, and this new special projects team of defense intelligence agents that Pentagon sets up on the other hand. And, you know, the FBI wants to conduct interrogations, as they always have, you know, not with torture, according to the law, with rapport building, which, of course, is very successful. And then you had this special unit set up by the Pentagon and, you know, up to including Rumsfeld, who personally signed off on Mohamedou's interrogation plan. And, you know, and that unit was importing these enhanced interrogation techniques that were, you know, so-called, that were being used in the black site. So all of the things you read about in Mohamedou's book and you associate with, you know, even with the Abu Ghraib photos were, you know, kind of mutated to them, but, you know, shackling in stress positions, strobe lights, you know, heavy metal music being played at, you know, ear-splitting volumes, subjection to, you know, extremely cold temperatures for hours, dousing with water. And in then Mohamedou's case, you know, sexual humiliation and assault, a fake kidnapping, death threats, and ultimately, you know, a threat to, he was told that the United States had captured his mother and was going to bring her to Guantanamo, the implication being that she would be, you know, raped by the men in Guantanamo. You know, those things, most people did not know that those things were going on. Even the men and women who were serving in the larger population in Guantanamo, and especially the people who were assigned to prosecute these people. So one of the most amazing aspects of what we know about Mohamedou's story, and one of the reasons we knew a good deal about it before his manuscript became public, was that the man who was assigned to prosecute him was a Marine Lieutenant Colonel named Stuart Couch. And Stuart Couch had gone through this theory training program, you know, so he knew a little bit about what it was and the fact that, you know, that these kind of techniques really amounted to torture, that they just, you know, you end up confessing whatever anybody wants you to. And he had gone to Guantanamo and sort of gotten a glimpse of one of these interrogations and was a little troubled by it. And he was getting all these intelligence reports supposedly, you know, containing all these confessions from Mohamedou. And he was quite suspicious. And so he worked with a Navy criminal investigative task force agent who managed to kind of breach this, you know, veil of silence that surrounded how these interrogations were happening. And they excavated from the, you know, military interrogation files information about how these interrogations had been carried out. And Lieutenant Colonel Couch himself concluded that Muhammad had been tortured and, you know, refused to prosecute his case. So, you know, like I say, systemic in the sense that they were absolutely calculated programs that were, you know, devised at the highest levels of these agencies and the civilian authorities overseeing those agents. Rampant, no, in the sense that, you know, they existed in, you know, in the deepest secrecy. That secrecy, of course, was a necessity because, you know, you're talking about illegal abuse, so that they existed in secrecy specifically in order to violate the Convention Against Torture. And then that secrecy has, you know, has continued up to this day, mostly, I think, because it's trying to hide the fact that the abuse happened and to protect the, you know, careers and reputations of those who ordered it and carried it out.
Along that note, reputations, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld, we have Guantanamo, and of course we have the infamous Abu Ghraib. Given that, at least to some level, Rumsfeld and Cheney knew what was happening, should they be prosecuted themselves for war crimes?
Well, you know, in the case of, you know, Muhammadu Fulahi, it's more of a case than, you know, knew what was happening. As I say, you know, we know from the Senate Armed Services Committee's investigation in 2008, which has several pages about Muhammadu's special project interrogation, we know that Donald Rumsfeld specifically signed his special interrogation plan, that is his torture plan. So, you know, this is more than just, you know, a wink and a nod in that case. I mean, the Convention Against Torture and U.S. law implementing the Convention Against Torture are absolutely clear. If, you know, when torture happens, those who order and carry out torture must be prosecuted, and those who have been tortured must receive restitution and must be made whole. So, you know, the law is unambiguous about what is supposed to happen. Now, you know, countries who have gone through periods of extreme human rights abuses, and I think we have to acknowledge the fact that the United States is, you know, in or emerging from such a period itself, you know, they have looked at different ways to handle that question of accountability and reckoning with torture. And, you know, in some cases, there's a truth-telling and truth and reconciliation process that involves pardons or apologies or something. I think there are many ways to approach this, but, you know, you cannot read Muhammadu Fulahi's book and not feel, you know, not only understand intellectually, but feel in your body, you know, what these torture programs mean, the damage that they would do not only to the person who's tortured, but also to the people who are torturing. One of the most moving elements of the book is, you know, his incredibly empathetic portraits of his guards and interrogators, who some of whom are, you know, quite anguished by what they do or what they've done. You know, so, you know, we do need to have a process that, you know, that conforms to international law and domestic law that prohibits torture, and this was clearly torture. There are many ways to do it. I think what's incredible about Muhammadu's book is that it, you know, he in a way opens this conversation and is moving that conversation forward.
Given that it was one of his earliest campaign promises in 2007, why has it been so difficult for President Obama to close down Guantanamo?
It's a really good question. I ask myself the question all the time. I get asked it all the time. I think, you know, the sequence of answers usually goes something like this. I mean, I believe that President Obama sincerely wants to close Guantanamo and has from the start. Now, that he has frequently and repeatedly been rebuffed in his efforts to do that. And so, you know, you sort of widen the circle and you say, well, Congress has not been cooperative. And indeed, you know, there was, you know, really promising movement over the last 6 months in Guantanamo. Things seem to be picking up pace. There seemed to be a real commitment to transfer out, you know, this year, the 50, more than 50 men who have been cleared for many years, you know, for release. And now we have a Senate that's controlled by Republicans, and the Senate Armed Services Committee is promoting a bill that is nicknamed the Guantanamo Forever Bill, which will strip President Obama's ability to transfer anybody out from Guantanamo, even those who we know are innocent and have been cleared for more than 5 years. So, you know, okay, then you say, well, you know, that Congress has been a clear obstruction. But I think you can, you know, I think many, if you push our congressmen and women on this, they would say, if they were really honest, that they continue to, you know, vote the ways that they are because they're afraid of the political consequences if they vote to close Guantanamo. They're afraid they'll lose re-election. And so that means that the, you know, really the responsibility is on the American people. I think it's, you know, it's time for the American people to take responsibility for closing Guantanamo. We need to, you know, read this book, understand what it means, just respond to its very simple human appeal for justice. It's, you know, it's an undeniable appeal. You read this book and you know that this man deserves to have the questions about his case answered and a decision made about what the rest of his life is going to be. You know, that's how justice works, case by case, individual by individual. And, you know, we shouldn't be able to sleep at night now that we have this story until his case is resolved and then on to the next one. And we need to send a message to our elected officials that, you know, no, they won't lose their jobs if they vote to keep close Guantanamo. In fact, they'll lose their jobs if they continue to vote to keep it open. You know, that's really what it means to be a, you know, an informed and an effective citizenry. And that's what we need right now. It's interesting because I think it's very clear that the military and all of the intelligence agencies are with the Obama administration on this. Everybody understands that Guantanamo is, you know, not only, you know, a system that's perpetuating grievous mistakes and concealing, you know, criminal conduct, but it's a huge stain and a very effective recruiting tool. It's, you know, doing daily much more harm than it is good, and all of our intelligence agencies know that, and the military knows it, and they all want to see Guantanamo closed too. So, you know, the American people just have to catch up on this one and start to communicate to our elected leaders that, you know, enough is enough, and Mohamedou should be freed, and, you know, we should go through and look at every single other case, you know, with the same sense of fairness and openness and transparency with which, you know, Mohamedou addresses his own experience in the book.
Well, it's a very fascinating and remarkable story, and it's an issue that will hopefully be talked about more now that this book is out by yourself and Mohamedou Slahi. Larry Seams, thank you so much for your time today.
Dan, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers.
That was Larry Seams. He's the editor of the book Guantanamo Diary and is a former fellow at the Penn Institute of New York, which is where I spoke to him from. This has been Endeavors on CGSF 99.1 FM, Burnaby, CGSF.ca, Telus HD channel 7014. My thanks to Larry Seams, my thanks to Scott Hellman, and my thanks to Thanasis Kambanis. Stay tuned for No Country for Old Men with Chris. Next week on the show, you will hear from Finland's Pasi Cylinder on the new educational policy there. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.